The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to the Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and we have two very interesting and two very different guests for you to close out the month of August. You will first hear from Maurice Jones, the president and CEO of the Local Initiative Support Corporation, more commonly known as LISC, and he'll tell us exactly what that organization does.
So LISC is a almost 40-year-old enterprise. Our mission, basically, is to work with partners at the local level to forge opportunities, communities of opportunity. That's what we're about.
And then you are going to hear from Derek Rapp, the president and CEO of JDRF, whose mission is to lessen the impact of type 1 diabetes from people's lives and ultimately to find a cure. He'll also explain what's the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes.
Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease where a person's body stops producing the insulin that is required to help a person convert sugar to energy. With type 2 diabetes, on the other hand, a person continues to produce that insulin, but the person's body becomes resistant or isn't able to work with the insulin as effectively.
But first, the Business Giving News Digest for Sunday, August 27th. Facing declining membership, the Boy Scouts of America wants to attract girls to its ranks, an effort that is not sitting well with the Girl Scouts of the USA. In a letter sent to the Boy Scouts board, the national president of the Girl Scouts accused the boys group of making disparaging and untrue remarks about her organization's programs. Large-scale social change requires many decades, a new report from the Bridgeband Group finds. They analyze catalytic social movements and interventions, things such as anti-apartheid and marriage equality movements, the creation of Sesame Street and the school lunch program, tobacco control efforts and polio eradication, and found that nearly 90% of the efforts needed more than 20 years to achieve significant and widespread results, with a median of 45 years. More than 4,000 religious leaders have signed a letter asking Congress to preserve, in its current form, the Johnson Amendment, a law that effectively bars faith-based organizations from making political statements from the pulpit, this according to a report from Religion News Service. And finally, with a strawless September campaign in Seattle, local businesses will swap out plastic straws for sustainable paper options, or just encourage customers to say no thanks. Across the U.S., we use and toss around 500 million plastic straws each day, which totals about 12 million pounds of plastic waste over a year. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Maurice Jones of LISC right after this.
Most teachers spend more than $500 of their own money on school supplies each year. That's because too many classrooms lack books, microscopes, art supplies, and even pencils. At DonorsChoose.org, you can help students and teachers get the resources they need for a successful education. Whether you support a field trip to a local museum, yoga mats for a health class, or technology to teach kids to code, you can join the 2 million individuals who've already made a difference in the classroom. Visit DonorsChoose.org to bring a classroom dream to life.
Welcome back to the Business of Giving. I'm Denver Frederick. LISC, or the Local Initiative Support Corporation, has a well-earned reputation for having become an incubator for innovation in the community development field, effectively aligning the public, private, and nonprofit sectors and catalyzing opportunities in both urban and rural communities. And with us this evening to tell us about that work and its impact is their president and CEO, Maurice Jones. Good evening, Maurice, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about LISC, the Local Initiative Support Corporation, and the mission and goals of the organization.
Absolutely. So LISC is a almost 40-year-old enterprise. Our mission, basically, is to work with partners at the local level to forge opportunities, communities of opportunity. That's what we're about. How we do it, we invest money in these communities. We bring other money and combine with ours. We serve as what I would call a backbone organization where we help get projects done. We work on public policy issues. And then we serve as an advisor to investors in these communities, as well as the communities and residents themselves who are trying to get work done. We're doing work in the affordable housing space. We're trying to get people prepared for jobs that make a living wage. We're trying to attack food deserts. We're trying to make sure that people have health facilities. Those are the problems that we're trying to solve through the means that I just discussed.
An absolutely holistic approach. As you alluded to, you're about 40 years old. You were founded in 1980. What have you been able to achieve and accomplish in those nearly 40 years?
Sure. In almost 40 years' time, LISC itself has invested over $17 billion in these communities. And I'll tell you more about our offices. We have offices, about 31 offices or so, all across the country in urban areas. And then we work with another 80 or so partners in rural areas. So we serve the rural areas in 44 states, 2,000 counties. We've invested $17.5 billion. We have aggregated or leveraged with that $17.5 billion, $52 billion of investments in these communities. 366,000 units of affordable housing and millions of square feet of facility space. And when I talk about facility space, I mean child care centers, schools, fields for kids and adults to recreate on, theaters, all the kinds of infrastructure that a community needs to be a true community of opportunity. We've facilitated or done all of that in that almost 40-year period.
A very nice track record indeed. You know, I kind of sometimes think that people have come to the conclusion that when it comes to addressing poverty, nothing really works. And that may be just a result of the steady diet of bad news that we're getting fed all the time. But you say that is essentially wrong. What is working and working well in tackling poverty?
There are so many things that are working and working well. So I'll give you an example. We have these enterprises around the country now called Financial Opportunity Centers. And the goal of a Financial Opportunity Center is to basically help an individual in one of these underserved areas get onto a pathway of a career making a livable wage job. You come into these centers and they're based in the communities where people live. You get three kinds of services. You get one-on-one coaching on the financial side. The goal there is get you a credit score or increase your credit score and get you to a point where you're making a budget so that you know what it takes for you to be cash positive.
There you go.
That's number one. The second goal is get you prepared for a job, career readiness. Now, what that often means, 70% of the residents that come through, they may actually have a high school certification or diploma or a GED, but their reading and their numeracy skill sets, 6th to 8th grade. We've got to help them get to 10th grade levels to get into a training program to get the right credential for a job.
And also probably help them with the soft skills, too.
No question.
Going on an interview and knowing how to handle themselves.
No question.
We're never taught that in school.
No question. And it's really important. And then the third area that they receive help in is we connect them with the kinds of assistance or investments that they need while they're trying to increase their wages. You know, help with child care, help with housing and food. That bundled group of services has helped individuals, thousands of individuals, improve their net worth, improve their credit scores, get jobs, stay on jobs long enough where you are earning a livable wage. Job tenure is a big piece of it.
Yeah.
It has helped transform people's lives. I talked to one individual who had been incarcerated for 7 years. He had a drug offense. He was in his 20s. He went through one of these financial opportunity centers. He came out of it in 24 months, and this guy was in a job where he was making $42,000 a year. That in and of itself was impressive, but what was most impressive is when you talk to him and you heard him say, I got something to lose now. You know, I got a daughter and I can help my daughter achieve what it transformed his life.
Yeah.
It wasn't just about the job. It was about this guy becoming a new being. That works, right? What our country has to do is invest more in that and they also have to stick with it, right? These are the one thing I will say about this work is it's patient work.
Oh, so this is not a quick fix.
This is not a quick fix. These are not quick fix challenges that
right.
we have.
Mm-hmm.
But, boy, there are things like that working all over the place. Affordable housing, same sort of thing. So, yeah, there are solutions out there, and we see them, and we're a part of them. We're trying to make sure that we can scale them across
yeah.
more communities.
Well, give us an example of one. As you said, you're in 31 urban centers around the
yes.
country, not to mention the rural ones, but you're in Buffalo and Flint and Duluth and Chicago and Boston and Houston and Jacksonville and Indianapolis and so on. Tell us how you go about this work as you're entering into one of these communities and where you invest and the impact that you've been able to have.
Sure. So, in general, the keys for us are, find good local partners. And what I mean by local partners are developers who are interested in developing affordable housing in a community, or workforce trainers who are interested in developing equipped talent
yeah.
in that particular community. So the first key is you got to build on the local assets. Right? So our belief is that the most important assets for opportunity are at the local level,
mm-hmm.
where people live. And so we first and foremost try to find local partners. It includes both nonprofit and for-profit.
Uh-huh.
It also includes non-government and government. We got to have all of them at the table. So that's the first thing. The second thing we do is we invest money and blood, sweat, and tears and time in building the capacity of those local partners. So I mentioned those financial opportunity centers. Well, what we do is find a local enterprise that's already doing some elements of this and invest in their transforming into becoming a full-fledged financial opportunity center.
You do not recreate the wheel.
We do not recreate it.
You make the wheel better.
We create new stuff, right?
Yeah.
We actually go in and help the assets that are there transform into becoming more effective, more impactful.
A very smart approach.
The third thing we do is we have to invest money, right? So we are investing grants, we're investing loans, we're investing technical assistance, and we're investing them in enterprises themselves, be it developers or businesses, but we're also investing in infrastructure. And by infrastructure, I mean it could be, if you're talking about a commercial facility, building, helping people take buildings that have been offline or dilapidated in basically bringing them back to life, putting them back on the market, helping people restore streets, rehabbing homes,
mm-hmm.
right? So the infrastructure that you need. And then in addition to that, what we end up doing is making sure we're working to bring together on a high-functioning team all these players to get projects done, right? So we are often herding cats,
yeah.
but that it works. That sort of combination of investing, aggregating resources, being a backbone to help implement, investing in the local capacity, it works.
Yeah.
It's a formula that works in urban areas. It's a formula that works in rural areas.
Yeah, well. And the missing piece so often is that backbone function.
Oh,
everybody
my goodness.
Wants to fund the program, but nobody wants to fund the backbone. But the backbone's what makes things work.
And the backbone is the hardest piece
mm-hmm.
because it's not a transaction.
Right.
Right? It's a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's another piece of this is what we find is if you truly want to help communities transform themselves, it's not about going in and building this housing there or constructing this facility.
They have to own it.
You have to become a part of the place that you're trying to be helpful to.
Mm-hmm.
You have to build relationships. You have to know the capacity. You have to know the weaknesses and the strengths. Yep, you have to own it
mm-hmm.
and have a stake in it. And that's fundamental to our model.
How has the loss of manufacturing jobs impacted your communities, and what is being done to address that loss of jobs?
The loss of manufacturing jobs has been a key challenge for us, right? That's really a big piece of what we're trying to transform from, right? That really is, in many of the neighborhoods where we're working now, it used to be the case that these neighborhoods had huge manufacturing sources that were employing thousands of people. Now you drive through these neighborhoods and there are formerly occupied facilities where manufacturers were that have nothing there, right? And so, and the population has declined as a result of that. The housing stock has declined as a result of that. The housing, the people have aged there, right? And so what we're trying to do is to go in and take an old manufacturing facility, for example, and turn it into an entrepreneur's incubator.
Yeah, retrofit it.
Right? Yes, that's exactly right. So the loss of manufacturing, you're asking a key piece, because for me, this is what I think often our country ignores. We are, the people and the places that we're working in are part of the American story. That loss of manufacturing is an American theme, right? And that is what we are often confronting and helping communities wrestle with where we work. That's not something that you can marginalize and say is just an issue related to poverty. No, no, that's an American issue. Mm. That's part of our story. And so the loss of manufacturing jobs across the country is what we're trying to be part of the solution for.
You know, you do all this work in the urban communities, but you also may be one of the few groups that I know that also has a huge footprint in rural areas.
Huge.
Tell us about your work there.
Well, as I mentioned, we're in 44 states, 2,000 counties, I believe it is, working in across America in the rural areas. And you look, it's the rural areas are confronting many of the same challenges. The state of rural housing is challenged across the country now. So we're often working with local actors to help rehab housing, manufactured housing in particular. Infrastructure is a huge, huge challenge and opportunity in rural America. Now, the uniqueness there is arguably the biggest infrastructure opportunity in rural America is broadband access.
Hmm.
If we can bring more broadband access to rural America, the opportunities for small business, the opportunities for rural America to become more connected to the economic mainstream, not just in America, but in the world, are enormous.
Game changer.
Game changer. And it is a, take Virginia, which is a case I know a little bit about. About 45% of rural Virginia lacks access to high-speed internet.
Wow.
45%. This is the 12th or 13th wealthiest commonwealth in the country, right? So imagine what that figure is for places that are poorer than Virginia.
They're going to be left behind.
You can't do anything without that. I mean, it's like oxygen. So, and then the other piece is talent development. You still have to invest in talent development. So we're trying to do all of those things, facilitate all of those investments also in rural America.
Yeah, and speaking of talent development, you really believe that the expectations that someone has of you, and in the case of LIS, the expectations you have of both the communities and the people you serve can make a huge difference. Why are expectations so important, and how does LIS maintain really high ones?
Yep. There's no question that expectations are important for us as a enterprise, because I want to make sure that we are aspiring truly that there are 43 million people living in poverty, I think, in America was the last count. I want to make sure that we're aspiring truly to try to bring about a movement to eliminate that, period. Mm-hmm. That's our life's work. We need to exhaust ourselves doing it. And to the extent you aspire to something less than that, guess what? That's where you end up, much less than that. So I think it's important for us as an enterprise with that kind of mission to aspire audaciously. But I also think it's important for the country's national interest to realize that our continued competitiveness and quality of life really depends on how well we continue to bring these communities that are low opportunity into the high opportunity arena, right? As I've traveled around the world, my appreciation for the fact that we live in a global economy, that we live on a global competitive arena, has been heightened. And we can't afford to have any places or any people that we are agnostic about, right? And so our expectations, if we truly want to be good stewards for the people who come after us, need to be audacious.
Yeah.
It's
an issue of patriotism almost, if you care about this country.
And it's, look, I have a 14-year-old daughter. I want her chances to be much greater than mine, just as mine have been much greater than my grandparents who raised me. And what that means is we have to care about... I used to have a music teacher now. I won't tell you how grace is what allowed me to sing, right, in this choir. But the music teacher would stop me every now and then, and he would say, look, Maurice, if you want this piece to be a great piece, you have to care about every note.
Mm-hmm.
We have to care about every person and every community in the country if we want to be great.
That's a lovely metaphor. Let's address your impact. How do you measure your return on investment, and are there other metrics of success?
We measure it in a number of ways. So we measure these concrete things, right? We jobs that are getting produced or acquired by the people we're trying to help, units that are getting put online or preserved, schools that are being rehabbed. So we have these metrics that are about the hard real estate and that are also about the people. But we also measure how well we are as a healthy business, right? So as the Catholic nuns would say, no margin, no mission, right? And so we have to be a healthy enterprise. So we are really proud. For example, we very recently got rated by Standard & Poor's with a AA credit rating, right? We took that AA credit rating and went to the public capital markets and raised $100 million.
Wow.
First entity of our kind to do that. So we also look at, you know, our loans and loan loss reserve and ratios that are economic ratios. And then I think the last piece I would say is we try to measure how we're doing with respect to attracting and growing and developing talent that is talent that looks like the places that we're working in,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that's about culture, that's about talent, et cetera. And so we have metrics that are also looking at those things as well.
Well, you're doing a lot of cool things. And one of them was at the beginning of August, Lyst announced this historic partnership with Facebook others to help meet the demand for affordable housing in Silicon Valley. Tell us about this partnership and your role in it.
We're really excited. So we're going to manage a fund. It's an $18.5 million fund that we're going to grow to $75 million. Going back to what I told you originally, we leverage dollars. So we're going to grow this fund to a $75 million fund that will add affordable housing in the Menlo Park and East Palo Alto areas,
mm-hmm.
the neighborhoods, the backyards of the headquarters of Facebook. Now, this partnership is actually, it's Facebook and a handful of community groups and us, as well as another CDFI that's actually out there locally. We're excited about this because look, it's putting affordable housing units on the map in a place where the affordable housing crisis is as intense as any place in the country.
No doubt.
Any place in the country. But we're also excited because you have a partnership that includes a business, a incredible anchor business from the technology sector. You've got local community-based organizations. You've got us as well, that who we will bring both a national experience as well as a local experience there. This could be a model not just for East Palo Alto or Menlo Park or for the Bay Area, but for places around the country. I am particularly excited that a technology company is embracing this work. This is a technology company that realizes that it has a corporate responsibility to make sure that the area where it works remains one where a balance of folks can afford to live, work, raise a family, and recreate. And we need more players from the technology space in the arena where we're working. So we're really excited.
Yeah, I find that really exciting for you because of the fact that in your line of business, most of your corporate partners are usually financial institutions
exactly, and banks.
And it is so hard to break out of that. This may be the breakout moment.
This is the, I want my invitation to all other companies in the technology sector is...
And others,
follow,
I'm sure.
And others as well. Follow Facebook's lead. Here's the thing. They can do it, right? This is the thing. With the help groups like ours and other community groups, these entities that are making incredible profits and, look, creating this digital revolution across the country can also wrestle these social problems to the ground.
You know, you've touched on this a little bit already, but I want to ask you more. The work that you do is really difficult work, and in order to be able to do it effectively, you have to have an engaged and an empowered and motivated staff. Tell us about the corporate culture at LISC and what about it that allows you and your team to be able to do this work.
Yeah. So one piece of the corporate culture at LISC is this, I believe, this invitation that LISC provides to people to make a difference in people's lives,
mm-hmm.
right? And what you find is that people want that, right? And that's of all ages, right? But particularly young people, you know, I hear people lamenting the now I can say younger, even though it's hard for me to say it, the younger generation.
You'll get used to it.
you hear them lament, but what I find is they are very similar to my generation in at least this one aspect. They want to make a difference in the world.
Yeah.
And what LISC's culture invites is people who want to make a difference. But we also are trying to create a culture that's about innovation, that's about using the market to solve social problems, right? So we consider ourselves a mission-oriented business.
Mm-hmm.
So we attempt to operate like a business, but a business with a distinct mission about transforming communities and people. And we try to hold ourselves accountable to business metrics that are customized to that mission as well. The other thing I would say is we also try to create multiple cultures within the organization. So we have a tax credit syndicator. We're the largest low-income housing tax credit syndicator in the country. We also have an affiliate that is really, really about business investment, right? And then we got people in the housing space. So the key for us is making sure that actually within one entity, you've got a healthy dialogue, you've got a healthy collaboration going amongst multiple cultures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's and a nice learning environment for everybody.
It sometimes can make you grow hair, although it hasn't done that for me. The one thing it hasn't done for me is made me grow hair.
That's next. Yeah. You know, you do have a remarkable story, Maurice. You were raised by your grandparents in Southern Virginia. Tell us a little bit about your journey to your current role as the CEO of LISC.
I can't say I planned it, but I can say that, yeah, my probably the most formative years were in a small town of 1,200 in rural Virginia on a tobacco farm raised by grandparents, a grandfather who was able to go to school in a barn for 6 years primarily because of his race, right? And a grandmother who did because she lived in town, so to speak, finished high school in 11 years, and that was what you could do there. So they taught me hard. They had three things they wanted me to do. Get all your education you can get, work hard at everything you do, and be nice, right? Those were their three aspirations. I went on and I practiced law for a little while, and I worked in state government and worked in federal government.
A lot in Virginia.
Yes, in Virginia and at HUD. And I worked in the philanthropic world for a while. My grandfather, if he looked at all of this, he would say, boy, you just can't keep a job. I have a different explanation, but that would be his.
Yeah, yeah.
He would probably be right, as he most often is. I will tell you, though, for me, this opportunity really resonated a lot because of my I was the Secretary of Commerce and Trade for Virginia in my last job.
Mm-hmm.
We had an incredible economic development record there. I think by the time I left that job, we had sort of a net job increase in Virginia of over 100,000 jobs.
Wow.
But 80% of those jobs went to two places, Northern Virginia around D.C. and mm-hmm. then the Richmond, Virginia area. And what was apparent to me was that the rest of the Commonwealth needed investment and work in order to become competitive as those two places. What really appealed to me about LISC is we work on that other 80% all the time,
yeah.
right? We are trying to get these other places to be as competitive as the Northern Virginians and the Richmond areas. That's what really resonated with me about this opportunity. I wanted to do that 24 hours.
This job was made for you.
Well, I feel blessed to be in it. It's a great job.
Let me close with this, Maurice. You know, we discussed a moment ago about high expectations you hold for the communities and the people in the places where you serve. And I know you hold similarly high expectations for the organization you lead. What is your vision for LISC over the course of the next 5 years or so?
So I particularly want us to lead the way in helping to get more folks in these communities where we are prepared to compete for livable wage jobs and careers. That's a particular aspiration of mine for LISC, and I think we are well positioned with our footprint in urban and rural America and with our 30-some offices and incredible partnership network to do that. But the second piece I want to do relates to what you mentioned with respect to Facebook. So historically, our anchor partners have been the financial institutions. We have to broaden our set of anchor partners. And I am particularly interested in the health community
mm-hmm.
and the technology sectors. Those two sectors in particular, in my mind, are so aligned with us in mission and so ripe to be vital partners in this work that I want to make sure I exhaust myself trying to forge new partnerships with those industries. I think if we can forge more partnerships with these types of anchor institutions, higher ed, technology, and health, the partners for this work for decades to come, and this will require decades of work, will be really, really sound. And that's what we need.
Well, you're certainly off to a good start.
Well,
Maurice Jones, the president and CEO of LISC, the Local Initiative Support Corporation, I really want to thank you so much for being here this evening and for a great conversation.
Well, thanks for having me. This is great.
For those who want to learn more about your organization, tell us about your website and what they might find on it.
www.lisc.org. If you go up on the website, you'll hear a lot of what we talked about today, but you'll see where we're working. You'll see how we work. You'll see stories. And I really, really commend the story. When you see the stories of how people are transforming places and people at the local level, it will give you that counterbalance that you need to all the bad news that's out there.
Absolutely.
I tell people all the time, I limit myself to cable news exposure at the end of the day because I don't want it to jade me when I go out every day and I see these incredible enterprises and people transforming lives in places around the country. But you can get all of that. You can see our business model. You can see all of that on our website.
Well, do what I do and eliminate it entirely. It serves no useful purpose. Thanks, Maurice. It was a real pleasure to have you on the
nice
program.
Nice to be with you. Thanks for having
me. I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
Babies sure don't come with manuals. And for their moms living in poverty, it can feel impossible to make ends meet. Thankfully, there's Nurse Family Partnership to help new moms be the best they can be. Their nurses are always there for moms throughout pregnancy and after the baby comes home. A mom can change her baby's world. Nurse Family Partnership can help guide her there. Join in changing the future for babies born into poverty. Visit supportnfp.org.
Welcome back to the Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
Anyone who knows a person with type 1 diabetes knows only too well how difficult it is to manage this disease. It requires attention every minute of every day. JDRF is working to lessen that impact from people's lives and ultimately to find a cure. And here to tell us about that work is the president and CEO of JDRF, as well as a parent of a son who has type 1 diabetes, Derek Rapp. Good evening, Derek, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening, Denver. Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us about JDRF, the history of the organization, and of your mission.
Sure. JDRF was founded in 1970 by a couple parents of children with type 1 diabetes sons, one in the New York City area, one in Philadelphia. And these were people who were determined to help their kids with type 1 diabetes one day be able to learn what it's like to live a life again without type 1 diabetes.
Yeah, and speaking of type 1 diabetes, what's the difference between type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes?
Sure. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease where a person's body stops producing the insulin that is required to help a person convert sugar to energy. With type 2 diabetes, on the other hand, a person continues to produce that insulin, but the person's body becomes resistant or isn't able to work with the insulin as effectively.
Good distinction. How many people in the U.S. are afflicted by type 1 diabetes?
We don't know for sure, but our guess is between 1.25 million and 1.5 million, probably.
Mm-hmm. And I know type 1 diabetes can strike both kids and adults, and it can come on very suddenly. Do we know what the triggers are that instigate this?
We know some. We're pretty confident we know some. We certainly know that genetics are a significant factor, but they're not sufficient. Let me share an interesting statistic.
Yeah.
About 50% of the time that identical twins, where one has type 1 diabetes, so does the other, which also, of course, means 50% of the time the other one doesn't.
Right.
And that tells you that genetics are important, mm-hmm. because that's far higher than it would be for other siblings who aren't identical twins. But at the same time, obviously, there's some factor that triggers the onset in those 50% who do get it.
Yeah. I'd be curious what that is, because I know that type 1 diabetes has been on the rise a little bit, but it's probably—
It sure has.
Yeah. Is there any explanation that you can even put forth?
Well, we know that certain viruses are significant. Viruses such as hand, foot, and mouth disease or Coxsackie virus, enteroviruses, mm-hmm. respiratory infections in the very young are believed to be significant in triggering an immune system in a person that amps up in order to fight that infection just like it's supposed to. But then for some people, unfortunately, that immune system doesn't calm back down like it's supposed to.
Mm.
Instead, it looks for another target, something else to do, if you will.
Got you.
And unfortunately for people with type 1 diabetes, that something else to do is to go target and kill the beta cells that produce the insulin in the body.
Mm-hmm. Well, your son Turner was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes back in 2004, and I would guess that no matter how much you may think you know this disease, you really don't fully understand it until a loved one has it. What is it like to live with type 1 diabetes?
Well, that's right. In fact, I had some good friends in college. My wife had four relatives who had type 1 diabetes before Turner was diagnosed, and so certainly the disease was around us. And yet, when it became part of our immediate family, only then did we start to understand the insidiousness of this, just the never-ending impact of this disease. So imagine a disease that requires a person to constantly be vigilant about what he or she eats and how much exercise that person is getting, and whether that person is stressed out by some factor, or whether a person has hormonal activity due to puberty or whatever it might be. All those factors can cause a person to process insulin very, very differently. So we know that a person with type 1 diabetes has to have a variable dose of insulin every day, different times of day,
mm-hmm.
and yet can still get it wrong. With too much insulin, perhaps causing a person to have a catastrophic event that can even include seizures or death,
yeah.
and too little insulin that will cause a person to have high blood sugar, both making that person perhaps concerned about the longer-term complications, but also even immediately about the possibility of diabetic ketoacidosis, which again can be catastrophic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an extremely complicated, demanding disease.
Mm-hmm. So what's his life like? I mean, what was it like? What does he have to do every day in terms of trying to manage this successfully?
Well, I'll first say as Turner's dad that I think he's doing fantastically.
Great.
I am relieved and proud and grateful. Turner wears a pump, an insulin pump, and many people think that that pump has the intelligence always to know when a person needs insulin. Well, truthfully, no. That's a pre-programmed device that will give insulin when it's told to, and that's going to happen whether or not that person needs insulin. I'll get to that some more in a second because I'm glad to say we're changing that.
Yeah.
And then Turner also wears a continuous glucose monitor, which is a device which is constantly reading and giving a new reading every 5 minutes his glucose levels in his body. And therefore, it allows him to know how he's doing, provided he is vigilant. And so then he has meals through the day, and he has to tell that pump that he's had a certain level of carbohydrates in that particular meal, or he watches his numbers, and if he's high or he's low, he needs to adjust accordingly. Turner is a very active guy. He has run 4 marathons. He recently did the New Jersey State Olympic Distance Triathlon.
Wow.
You know, he's doing a lot. In fact, a week from Saturday, he'll be riding 100 miles with me in Colorado, and therefore, he needs to know how his body is doing all through that time and adjust his insulin levels and his sugar intake accordingly.
Yeah. So what are the implications of a high glucose level and, on the other hand, when it's low? What are the impact of those?
Diabetes is the leading cause of adult onset blindness, of extremity amputations, second leading cause of heart disease, leading cause of kidney failure, and a lot of other issues as well. So when a person has poor control over time or even variability of the blood sugar level, that puts a lot of strain on the body, and it can lead to those different complications. So that's a big concern always. I mentioned earlier the possibility of diabetic ketoacidosis, which is when a person's electrolytes get so out of whack that the organs then start to do some strange things and even perhaps to shut down. So that can, as you might imagine, lead to terrible consequences. So that's the discussion of the high blood sugar.
Mm-hmm.
On the low blood sugar side, when a person has too much insulin versus the amount of carbohydrates that he or she has brought in.
Right.
So for the rest of us who don't have type 1 diabetes, our bodies have all these different regulators in us that can allow us to constantly adjust. But a person with type 1 diabetes doesn't have the ability to regulate that way. And so with low blood sugar, a person can go into seizure, into coma, and into death. And it's all
more serious, isn't it?
It can happen very quickly.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the ketoacidosis can happen quickly, too. I hear too many frightening stories. And in fact, as many people die of ketoacidosis as do of low blood sugar with type 1 diabetes.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about some of the work that you do in research. And it was about a decade or so, Derek, that JDRF launched the Artificial Pancreas Project. And this was a tremendous collaboration to accelerate progress in an effort that has really transformed the field. Where do we stand right now with the development of the artificial pancreas?
Sure, you're right. This is one of our prouder accomplishments over the last decade plus. At this point, the first hybrid closed-loop artificial pancreas system has been commercialized. Let me explain that long term I just used. So hybrid closed-loop means that it's not a perfectly automatic system.
Mm-hmm.
I described earlier that pump wants to keep producing and expressing insulin. So what we want to do is we now want to have a system that will know when to turn off if a person has too much insulin, not enough sugar in his or her body, or will automatically administer insulin when a person has high blood sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have a system that will do that. Now, we still are telling the system when a person's still telling the system when that person's having a meal,
right,
in order to try to help that system catch up with the load of carbohydrates that will be coming in through a meal. But it's allowing a person to have much tighter control than otherwise would be the case. We'll have several systems like that will be commercially available in the next few years, and they'll keep getting smaller, easier to wear, more accurate, et cetera. So great progress in that area. And I want to also mention about this that it's not just about the research. It's also about the advocacy work that we do. So, in fact, we work with the Food and Drug Administration here in the U.S. to help the regulators know the importance of bringing these therapies along. And as part of that, to providing a roadmap that will allow the companies that make these devices to know what they need to do in order to have a regulatory approval. So back some years ago, when we knew that the different companies in this space had their continuous glucose monitors and they had their pumps and the systems that might put it all together, but they weren't producing the full systems, it was because they were seeing a lot of uncertainty at the FDA in terms of what would be required in order for them to be able to get a product approved. And so we started a very public campaign to impress upon the FDA the importance of laying out that roadmap. And eventually, after our insistence, the FDA did just that. And that's why we now have one of these products already available and others that are coming along. So, our work in advocacy is very, very important.
Yeah, well, it just seems like that's a byproduct of the time you spent in the private sector. And knowing how important it is that companies know what the rules of the game are in order to get them to get on board.
There's nothing that a business person hates more than uncertainty.
Absolutely.
They can handle bad news, maybe it adjusts the valuation or whatever else, but that uncertainty paralyzes people.
It sure does. Another area that has received a lot of attention recently is encapsulation. What is encapsulation?
Well, in fact, I'm holding right now in my hand a non-mechanical device that is exactly one of the examples we have. So the idea of encapsulation is that cells that would express the insulin are put inside of a small device, and this device that I'm holding almost feels like a Band-Aid, though mm-hmm. it's made of algae. Cells would be put inside of that device, and the device will hide those cells from the body. So therefore, the body won't want to reject or attack and destroy those cells. The fluid will pass through a membrane and tell those cells when a person has high blood sugar, and then those cells will naturally express the insulin that will pass through the membrane and out to the body and help a person stay in range. A device like this might work inside of a person for a couple years without the person having to do anything at all to control his or her glucose levels, no shots, no testing, anything.
Very exciting.
Yes.
You probably have, 60 or 70 clinical trials going on right now. Some
That's
in
right.
the advanced stages of testing. What are one or two that really excite you?
Well, personally, I could say many. It's like choosing among your children, I guess. But I'm very excited about our work in prevention because I am quite confident that we will at least significantly delay, if not truly prevent, this disease for lots of people. So I look at clinical trials that we have going right now in the application of different drugs from other autoimmune diseases to type 1 diabetes, because we know that the correlation among different autoimmune diseases is high.
Yeah, that's very
interesting. And so we're trying to get to the fundamental mechanism that causes these different autoimmune diseases and see if we can use that as a way to keep a person from ever getting type 1 diabetes in the first place. Or we have also discovered some important steps in the process that leads to the destruction of those insulin-producing cells. And we now believe that we have some ways to perhaps stop those steps from happening and therefore protect the insulin-producing cells in the body. So those are some trials that excite me a lot. You mentioned encapsulation. There are multiple mm-hmm. encapsulation trials that are happening right now. You mentioned artificial pancreas. We have lots where we are testing better systems that will allow those devices to work together more effectively, easier to wear devices, all kinds of things.
Yeah, exciting times to be in the field. Type 1 diabetes, among all the other challenges it presents, is not an inexpensive disease. I mean, there's the cost of insulin, insulin pumps. You just were talking about artificial pancreas systems.
That's for sure.
How do insurance companies do, by and large, in covering these costs?
So it's another area of our advocacy effort, is working hard to make sure that people have access to these important therapies and on a reasonable basis. I would say that my answer to you is that we have a mixed story to talk about, mm-hmm. to be honest, and the JDRF is working hard to try to improve that story some more. So when I say it's mixed, so what are some good examples? What are some not so great? A great example is the fact that 98% of people who have private insurance are able to access a continuous glucose monitor now with coverage.
Good.
Likewise, pumps are highly covered by the private insurers. So those are good stories, and those are stories that are very much a product of the work that we did at JDRF in order to prove that there is a good business proposition for these companies to go ahead and provide coverage. In other words, that people are going to have better outcomes, mm-hmm. and ultimately that means that insurers are going to have to spend less on the devastating complications that would come later on as a result of worse coverage, or else in emergency room visits. Each time a person goes to an emergency room, that costs $25,000 or so, and if we can have better, tighter control of glucose that keeps those emergency room visits down, then obviously that's saving a lot of money for the system too. So those are some places that are good. In fact, a great victory that we had just this winter was for a long time, Medicare was not providing coverage on continuous glucose monitors for people with type 1 diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, a person who's over 65 years old, has had type 1 diabetes for a long time, is highly at risk for hypoglycemia under unawareness.
Yep.
In other words, he or she doesn't feel the lows anymore, and that can lead to those terrible consequences. Instead, with this device, is able to stay aware of things. So we were able to finally, after many years of working with Medicare and Medicaid folks, CMS, we were able to convince them to go ahead and classify continuous glucose monitors as a durable medical equipment, which in other words means that it is eligible for that sort of coverage. So that was a great accomplishment. I'm very proud of that.
Congratulations.
Indeed. You mentioned insulin. Insulin pricing is a concern right now. You probably read it. It's a big concern.
Yep.
For our community. The list price of insulin has increased dramatically over the last, call it, 15 years
mm-hmm.
or so. Now, interestingly, the net price, the price that many people pay through their insurance providers, has held reasonably flat, as reported at least. But obviously not everybody has access to that sort of protection. And so for many people, they're having to make really worrisome decisions right now in their lives about how they can help people have this essential ingredient in their lives, the insulin, and still have the rest of their lives be intact too. So we will continue to try to help people do that. We have a campaign right now called Coverage to Control,
mm-hmm.
where we are helping to rally this community and help the different parties, the insurance companies and others, to understand that they have an obligation to help people with type 1 diabetes do better. And by the way, that in doing so, they're actually going, again, to have better business outcomes too, because people are going to have better health outcomes as a result of having better control.
Well, that is always the case you have to make, that's for sure.
Yes.
Earlier this year, JDRF experts, you developed this first ever guidelines for safe exercise for people with type 1 diabetes. What
that's
were some
right.
of those recommendations?
Well, that's right. So let me start with a really basic one, which is that it's important that people get exercise.
Yeah.
I will tell you that many people with type 1 diabetes are warned against at least strenuous exercise because their doctors or caregivers are so concerned about a catastrophic hypoglycemic event or low sugar event that will occur as a result of that extreme exercise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having watched our son who is a marathoner and whatever, I can tell you that his glucose management, while it's challenging, he's a much healthier guy because of the fact that he gets a lot of exercise. And we see that routinely with people who have type 1 diabetes who are getting the exercise. So the first thing is, yes, go ahead and get that exercise. Understand how your body responds to the exercise. Adjust your glucose levels accordingly. Know when you need to have energy come in the form of glucose or whatever. But get to know your body and go ahead and get that exercise that you need. Specifically, we know that people who have type 1 diabetes, when they get a lot of exercise, it's important that they warm down as opposed to stopping abruptly.
Ah.
That when they do that, their bodies have a more even keel with their glucose management afterward. That's one very specific example. There are many things like that. There were 80 at this ride that I just last weekend in Wisconsin with JDRF. There were 80 riders there who rode, and most of them probably rode 100 miles that day, you know, with type 1 diabetes, and they're able to do it knowing that they are managing their glucose levels all along the way. And so they can do it, and of course, it's an inspiration to us all.
Sure, and it prevents a whole host of other problems for their health that they would otherwise perhaps have if they did not exercise.
Absolutely. So there's a picture of Venn diagram with three circles in it. The first one is A1C, which is kind of a weighted average level measuring the blood glucose level in a person. Another circle is cholesterol level, and a third circle is blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Only 3% of people with type 1 diabetes in this country are in the good part of all three of those circles.
All right.
So we know that people need the exercise.
Big
they
issue.
Need to help their hearts and their bodies to do better.
You know, we talked a little bit about your advocacy efforts already, but another part of that is what you call the JDRF's Children's Congress, and you were down in Washington earlier this summer. What were some of the highlights from that?
Oh, it's an amazing experience. 160 kids from around the country came and were together and then had meetings with their representatives or their senators. We had hundreds of meetings that week, and then we also had a Senate hearing where senators, it was chaired by the Senate Diabetes Caucus. So you have Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Susan
yep.
Collins, and others who were there, and it's very powerful to hear the testimonies from both children with type 1 diabetes and then some parents and adults with type 1 diabetes all talking about the demands of type 1 and about the importance of continued research funding. So our major push while we were there was continued funding of a special diabetes program,
right,
which is a program that is up for renewal right now in Washington that would continue funding of about $150 million a year through NIH funding of type 1 diabetes-related projects. It's very important that that work continue.
You know, speaking of funding, there is no shortage of research opportunities that are waiting to be explored. And I would imagine, Derek, that funding is a challenge, so you can pursue as many as you possibly can. What's your funding model and your sources of revenue?
Well, we have many.
Yeah.
So we our traditional fundraising approach has been a lot through events.
Mm-hmm.
So the walks and galas and the rides and the runs account for, let's call it roughly three-quarters, a little less, but close to three-quarters of our revenues. Then corporations also donate rather significantly. And then major donors, leadership givers, account for a significant portion. And then people's estates as they pass away,
mm-hmm,
are also an important source of funding. So we have many. I'm very excited about a new program that we started just this year called the JDRF T1D Fund. It's sort of an in-house venture capital fund that we have that is making investments in T1D-related therapies inside of corporations. So this is actually something that JDRF has been doing for a while, but this fund now really shines a spotlight on this activity and is helping people who are interested in the space, I think, see that they have a chance to support JDRF in a very exciting way. We've made investments in seven companies so far and activities such as artificial pancreas and encapsulation, prevention, different approaches toward biologically curing this disease and looking at the basic immunology of the disease. So as we drive that entrepreneurial space, we will take the basic research that we've been funding for many years and we will bridge through the so-called valley of death so that these companies then can get to a place where their therapies can be on a fast track toward commercialization.
That can really speed things up. That's
exactly.
Very, very exciting, very innovative. I know you're really proud of the team at JDRF and have looked to create a work environment where people are empowered and they're encouraged to do great work. How would you describe the corporate culture of JDRF, and is there anything that makes it special and distinctive?
Well, how I would describe it is I think what makes it special, which is it's very much a mission-driven organization. We, throughout the 700 or so employees and the countless volunteers, and believe you me, volunteers are a key piece of this organization too. We focus on and understand and appreciate the importance of our mission. JDRF's vision is very simple, a world without type 1 diabetes. And our mission statement is accelerating life-changing breakthroughs in the cure, prevention, and treatment of type 1 diabetes and its complications. That is the hallmark.
Mm-hmm.
That is our North Star. We focus on that with every decision that we make. In order to make that happen, we have 77 chapters around the country, and we're headquartered here in New York City. These chapters are the front line. They are out there both to help people with type 1 diabetes and their families, and then also obviously to raise funds and awareness. And then we here in New York, I hope, are helping them to do their jobs and then making sure that we bring it all together in a package that is coordinated, efficient, and highly effective.
Sounds like you've done that. Let me close with this, Derek. You know, as we discussed, type 1 diabetes is a rough disease, and not just for the person afflicted, but for the entire family.
That's right.
As someone who understands it not only at the professional level, but also at the personal level, what advice would you have for a person on the best way to view it, approach it, the kind of mindset that helps someone deal with it?
So I would say that there's no one approach to this disease for sure, and it's important that a person understand how he or she can best live with this disease.
Mm-hmm.
In our family's case, obviously, we started talking about it right away, and we made this a mission for our family for sure. Our friends and other family members have been right there along with us. And I see that routinely. I see this community come together so strongly and be determined to help us defeat this disease. It's a hard disease to take on alone, and I see some people who want to keep it to themselves. And I do think that's a challenging way to live.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's not for me to say what the right way is for a person to handle this. But people should know that this community wants to support and be there for each other and help people learn the tips that will allow people to have better control and do better and get through school and pregnancy and the different stages of life. So that's a big piece of what I would say. The last thing I would say, if I may, is do not strive for perfection. because there's no such thing as perfection probably in anything, and there certainly isn't in type 1 diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say don't strive for perfection, I don't want people to get hung up with it, because I often say that type 1 diabetes management is sort of like trying to catch a butterfly that's always floating around. And you think you've got it for a second, and then it floats, and the target is constantly moving. And I see families that are sometimes so focused on trying to get everything so perfect that it can really govern their lives, and it's tough. And we need to understand that each moment is just that. It's a moment, and we do our best from that moment forward, and we learn where we can, and then we try to stay positive and keep moving on.
Good advice. Don't get too rigid. Stay flexible.
Yeah.
Well, Derek Raff, the president and CEO of JDRF, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website, the kind of information that you have there, and how people can get involved in supporting the organization if they're so inclined.
The website is jdrf.org. As I said, we have chapters around the country, including right here in New York City. And you can easily, if you punch on the website, it'll take you right to the chapter connection.
Well, thanks, Eric. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Denver.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be Richard Toefel, the president of ProPublica. As newspapers and other media outlets have had to cut back on investigative reporting because of cost, ProPublica has come along with a nonprofit business model that is picking up some of the slack. So I hope you'll be on hand for that conversation. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your last week of what many of us consider to be summer, and do return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.